Welcome to the Babe Lab Podcast. This is the second part of episode 3, and obviously, you have nothing better to do than listen to these idiots, so enjoy, motherfuckers.
Alright, so Mars, I guess. I think I ran into it on a podcast, maybe, where they were talking about, data that had come back from the original Viking lander in 1976, and so they had one experiment that suggested that there was life on Mars, and then they had another one that basically was conclusive, like, there is no life on Mars. And they're looking back at the there is no life on Mars experiment and finding out that maybe it wasn't so good, because apparently it can't detect a life on it. Like, if you send this thing to the Antarctic, it would just be like, hey, this planet's dead. Its sensitivity to, it was basically sensing organic molecules.
It doesn't even work on Earth?
Yeah,
doesn't
work in the
exactly,
Antarctica.
Earth, which is just caked in life, right? So, this
you think they would have tested that?
You would think. So, give them a break. This is 1970s.
It was the 70s.
Yeah, exactly.
What's the Vietnam War?
This is actually a long-standing controversy. I read about this a long time ago, yeah.
Oh.
There's all the conspiracy theory and stuff. Because because that particular experiment, I think they used some organic molecules that were isotope tagged. And
right.
The idea is that if they get oxidized and used, and then the carbons get transferred into carbon dioxides and things like that, they could detect the gases then after, and then know something had actually used these organic molecules. And then they were actually positive.
That was a positive test.
They were positive.
Yeah.
And then the people were like, well, we don't know the chemistry. We think it's inorganic chemistry that's happening in the soil.
Yeah.
We don't really understand what's in the soil. So they completely wrote off those experiments.
Because of the other ones, though. I mean, you wouldn't just write that on itself. It was like the other test that said, whoa, there's no organic molecules.
Okay, but I guess it's been known for a long time, and lots of people that thought this is a conspiracy theory or something. It's been a controversy for a very long time.
Yeah,
and now this sort of resurfaced because we're looking at different tests that we want to do, and people have gone poured over the data once again and said maybe it wasn't so wrong in the first place, and we should try to figure out what's going on in the Martian soil.
And so yeah, what was interesting in this article is they tried to one of the other reasons why it's being readdressed is because of new research in extremophiles, all these life forms that exist in these extreme environments and stuff, and they're thinking, if life can exist here, in this ridiculous place on Earth, maybe there's potential for it to exist in ridiculous places on extraplanetary. And they have this wicked microbe that they talk about that exists that feeds on radiation. So I don't know if you guys checked out this link, but it's these bacteria that live deep, deep, deep underground. They grow extremely slowly, and they're able to derive their energy from actually radioactive particles.
So apparently it's the radioactive particles that split water into hydrogen and oxygen, and they use the put the water back together and use that energy.
Exactly, yeah. They split, their cell divisions are 45 to 300 years apart. So, this is to me this sounds absolutely crazy. It's from a phylum of bacteria that's been known before, Firmicutes or something. there's even other strains in this specific habitat. So, to me that says, I don't know if life had to exist before to get this type of extreme environment living bacteria or not, but it certainly opens the door for other types of habitats that you would never think of before, on other planets.
Yeah, what's incredible, they say here, it's 1.7 miles underground. Think of the pressure there. And it's 125 degrees Fahrenheit.
It's so far that it's hot.
And the pressures are crazy.
I wonder when that changes. You start off at surface temperature, which is whatever, and you go down and it gets colder and colder and colder.
Well,
and at some point, it starts to get warmer.
I know in the mines in northern Ontario, it's actually really warm, down, because these mines are 2 kilometers down. And
only 2 kilometers down, and it starts to get hot, eh?
Yeah. It starts to get up really.
But Like, I mean, the extremity thing, I mean, I don't think that's, you know, like, all you need for life is some energy and some chemicals, and, you know, some energy, you know.
But before, the idea was very specific energy sources and very specific, like, you know, who would have thought that, like, they're feeding directly off the energy derived from radiation. I don't think anybody would ever
thought
that. Oh,
for sure, yeah. But, I mean, it's just, you know, it's an energy source and it drives a chemical reaction, and they've, you know, you have a life form
that
uses it, right?
But and that's, doesn't that
in
just
terms of, like, the extremeness, though, like, you know, that's kind of relative to, like, extreme to us, you know.
Yeah.
Ours seems extreme
exactly.
to us, but the question is not how extreme is it. The question is
there
does an
it
energy
have
source?
Things?
Are there chemicals
yeah.
that are capable of giving rise to?
And this sort of broadens the idea of what can be done, like, what life can exist on. Because
right.
I don't think
sure.
that, I don't, I mean, I would have never thought of something like this.
And they were saying that the conditions that they found, you know, microorganisms in Antarctica, like the alcohol it was, or down there, like the pressure and stuff, you can find those exact same conditions on Mars. So the question is, are there bugs there? And otherwise, we can easily plant bugs there if we wanted to. Because
yeah.
the conditions are good for their survival.
Yeah.
It's just we need
I
to
wonder
go
if we've already
yeah,
contaminated
yeah.
with
yeah,
that.
Like how sterile is like the Mars rover and like all
yeah,
stuff.
Exactly. Did they sterilize that thing before they sent it
down?
I
hope so.
Maybe
they try.
Yeah.
You gotta wonder though, like life is such a like, you know, self-propagating and, you know, we have evolution of, you know, processes that happen. Once you have life, it starts to evolve. And so ultimately on Earth, it didn't stop at just bacteria, for example. So you got to wonder, like, if you don't see life on a large scale, you know, A, there's probably no life there, or B, it's only, you know, arisen very, very recently, or, you know, maybe some bacteria jumped off Earth and got onto Mars or something very recently or something like that, but...
Or couldn't it be that it used to be, like, full of life and now it's almost dead?
Well,
like, couldn't you imagine we kill ourselves off and, like, basically there's only bacteria left on Earth?
I don't know. I mean,
yeah.
I don't, yeah, that's a good question, though, as to whether or not, like, you would get this abundance of life and whether or not it would, you know, totally destruct itself or whether just new life forms keep...
Yeah.
You know, it seems to be what happens is every time we have mass extinction so far and, you
yeah.
know, all kinds of atmospheric things happen,
yeah.
global warming phenomena, this kind of stuff, that some
yeah.
other new species just takes its place and life is so robust that... It
yeah, basically
doesn't
that's what this says, eh? It's like, life is super robust and, like, I don't know, yeah. Totally makes me think, like, yeah, of course, it can be anywhere. It blew me, like, I don't know, we were talking about SETI and, like, oh, life exists. Okay, whatever. Life exists out there somewhere. Right? Like, I mean, it's just, like, infinite planets, infinite possibilities, of course, it happened again somewhere else. But, like right next door, that would suggest that life is, like...
Really pervasive.
Really
yeah.
pervasive.
Yeah, but then how come, you know, for example... Well, anyway.
I wonder if that Stephen Hawking thinks about.
I don't know if he's still like.
He probably had the answer to that question if he wasn't passed out.
Yeah, yeah.
Very good to boost, Stephen.
Right on. What's up next?
Just the word of the week I want to talk about because, first of all, it sounds like mutation. So the word is mutation. And I was actually doing a Google search for. Drosophila mutations, and I mistyped the word mutation. I put in that instead. And I found out it's actually a word. Mutation means first off the act of nodding one's head, so a little bit like Stephen Hawking does. second, in botany, it means spontaneous movements of plants during their growth. In astronomy, it's a periodic oscillation. For example, on the Earth's axis, as it, you know, the precession of the equinoxes. And mechanics is just, you know, an inclination of the axis of a gyroscope. But what I wanted to show here are videos of dancing plants. And this is wicked. So there's a bunch of people that were working on plant movement.
Oh, I never even saw this.
And they were going after... mutants that moved more, where the regulation of these like mutation genes that provide movement during growth are like mutated, and these plants just move all the time.
Mutations?
Yeah, they're just moving all the time. So there's like these great movies of like, you know, plants that look like you're doing the hula hoop.
Are you sure it isn't just like one of those ones that you play music next to? And
yeah, yeah.
One of those.
battery-powered.
So this is like the precursor to interpretive
dance? Yeah, exactly. It's like, so the female plants can see the moves. So they've got like adult Arabidopsis, where normally they shouldn't be moving, but because they've got this mutation, like even though they're not growing that much, they're still moving like crazy.
Wow. I always wondered how vines like manage to find their way up something. Like,
yeah.
That is absolutely crazy.
Yeah, so they've got also a video where you see a vine and how it moves.
I'm looking at the vine one right now.
It's like swirling and swirling and so that it like finds something to grab on and be able to grow.
See, I had this troublesome vine at home, like on the patio. And I don't know, I didn't want it growing in a certain place. So I come out there every day, and sure enough, it's like latched on to this new area. And so I take it and throw it away, and it's like there's no way it could possibly get there. Every time I come back out on the patio, like the damn vine is grabbed onto the same place. Of course, I never see it dancing around when I'm around, you know? So I'm always like, what's it doing?
I don't know if it's a closet dancer.
I don't know. At first, I figured it was just the wind blowing it, and it would grab whenever the wind blew it. But I don't know. After seeing that.
It's actually interesting because there's all kinds of like mathematical constraints that these plants have. For example, they always go counterclockwise, and you also find
symmetry in the universe.
Every plant goes counterclockwise.
Like, do they go counterclockwise in the southern hemisphere?
No, actually, they don't.
Are they left-handed or right-handed?
If you look at plants also, and if you look at where the branches stem off, and they'll always go in a circle, and it'll be a spiral that's going to be counterclockwise also. And there's also weird things, like the petals on a flower, it follows the Fibonacci suit. So you know where you've got 1, 2, 3, 5. So it's always, the next number is always an addition of the two last numbers. So there's like these weird things that happens where, you know, fractals and things like that. So plants are really interesting on a physical perspective too.
Plants are mathematicians.
Yeah. Well, I read this whole book on the golden ratio, which is like what dictates like what's basically Fibonacci based or whatever in like the plant petals and stuff, which... It was kind of an interesting read, but a little too math-heavy and not enough, like, cool plant like, descriptions, but
that's why you need videos.
It's like, these videos are awesome. Like, that sensitive plant one is pretty cool. But they put the flame to it, and, like, the leaf just folds up.
Yeah, they are pretty cool. They're worth checking all of them out, because I don't think of plants being that active. And some of the obviously it's, like, time lapse, but, like, some of them, the time lapse is only, like, 10 minutes between frames, and, like, crazy.
The next post I'll go quickly over.
It's the monster.
It's the Bay Journal Club recap. I'll just talk about some of the highlights. And I think one of the cool papers that we talked about here, and it actually uploaded a video from Nature. And so far, no cease and desist letter, but I'm crossing my fingers that it won't come after me.
It's of YouTube quality.
Yeah, so YouTube doesn't really like QuickTime, so it, like the frame rate is poor compared to the real video. But it has to do with nanobodies. And these are these like single chain, you know, camel/llama style antibody that are fused with GFP. And you can get the cells to express them, you can transfect them or something, or infect them, so that the cells themselves express the nanobody, and it's going to be inside the cell. You can do live imaging, which is absolutely wicked. So in the video that I posted, there's a nanobody against PCNA, so which is important for replication during the S phase, and you totally see where PCNA goes. And early on, you know, it starts in like certain foci that replication forks. Then you see it going around the nuclei during that late S phase replication for pericentric heterochromatin.
It's Carolyn that did that paper, isn't it?
Yeah, so Carolyn talked about that paper. And then I talked about a paper on male contraception. So this is really interesting. It's like this this toxin that like disrupts cell-cell junction. So you need basically the little primer on sperm formation. For the spermatocyte to develop, it needs support from the Sertoli cells. And Sertoli cells are FSH-dependent, so there's this hormone that circulates, and they take up the FSH, and in response, you know, they'll push the spermatocyte to differentiate and things like that. So what they've done is they coupled FSH with this particular therapeutic, which is really toxic. And so they managed to, like, again, Trojan horse delivery, so that only the Sertoli cells would get that drug, and that drug basically disconnects the Sertoli cells, so there's like no communication anymore, and the sperm cells just don't grow. So basically, what you've got is like a potential male contraception pill. And one of the interesting things is that whenever anybody has tried to do a male contraception pill, it always fails because whatever you give that stops sperm production is toxic to the brain. Because somehow the tissues in the brain and the tissues in the testes are very, very similar in their like lipid chemistry and like their cell, you know, biological properties.
And they're rugae?
And the what?
The rugae?
Never mind.
Oh, people think with their testes a lot. Right?
Yeah, that's exactly what I said when he was talking about it.
Yeah, that's what I...
You see it all the time. Those guys fighting in the bar.
I find it really strange how like the testes are so similar to the brain. Like, it makes no sense to me. Like,
well, maybe
why?
It's like a secondary brain. It just takes over sometimes.
I guess.
It's like enough of this. Like, enough of this thinking. Like, we gotta get some action. Oh, looking at that, though, I'm just thinking, like, you know... Because women have been taking contraceptives for, you know, quite some time.
Exactly.
And I'm just thinking, like, they're a lot braver than I am. Because I look at that and I'm just like,
whoa,
hitting Sertoli cells, Genesis, like, I don't want anything near
that. Like, it's
like
my brain.
Don't put that in me. I don't even care if it affects my brain, but I don't want things messing around with my Sertoli cells.
But I guess
the
thing
average
is,
contraceptive user probably doesn't have that, you know, high knowledge of science.
Yeah.
When you start pissing Sertoli cells, you know something's wrong.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I think the difference is, like, if potentially the consequence was having a child, like, when you didn't want it, maybe you'd reconsider, like, the, you know, consequences. If it had gone through FDA approval.
Yeah.
Like, especially now, women with contraception, like, they have lots of long-term studies on it now, right? Like, there's a lot of women who have been taking the pill now for a lifetime, and, like, basically all the consequences and stuff are known, and so...
But this is really different.
This is
in females,
it is really different.
In females, it's like hormones that are natural in their circulation. Here, you're putting a drug that's toxic.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, like, hormones are the most powerful chemical, you know, probably the most biologically active and sort of multifunctional kinds of things you can have in your body.
Yeah.
You know?
And dosing is really important, so they used to give way too much in the contraception pills for the women. Like, now they're safe, but they didn't used to be safe because there was just too much of it. But surprisingly, like, male contraception pills and, like, female hormones have been used for, like, thousands of years. Like, we certainly didn't invent it. Yeah. So the Egyptians were using, like, a type of plant that...
18?
That had a female estrogen, you know, compound in it. And actually, in the whole Mediterranean region, they used so much of that plant that it went extinct. There's none left. But Cleopatra was supposedly on contraceptive pill. Like, she was taking that plant. Lots of women were taking that plant at the time.
Wow.
In Mesoamerica, like in the Americas, people were using the sweet potato-like plant. Same family, and that contained a lot of, you know, female
hormones. I always just think of, like, you know, the need for contraception as being such a modern thing.
Yeah.
Because, like, back in the day, like, I mean, you want kids, right? I mean, kids are
infant
your future. You want kids basically all the time.
You're going to die by the time you're 20 or something.
But it must not have been like that, because people were using, like, sheepskin condoms and shit like that.
Well, I bet you the upper classes. Like,
yeah.
The really rich
some
people,
people,
like, they probably live longer and whatever.
There's another paper here that's worth discussing a little bit.
I don't know.
No? No, but the P53 senescence one.
Oh, yeah.
Where... Yeah, P53 doesn't do anything. But
that's right.
Nothing related to CERT. I'm going to get to the thick of the paper right away. And they suggest in that paper that P53-dependent senescence in the stroma of tumors is important for tumor genesis. So they're saying that the stroma is, like, key in supporting the tumor. Without stroma, the epithelial tumor cells do not grow. And that not only that, but these stromal cells need to be senescent. And that they can only be senescent if P53 is there. This is sort of surprising, because you know usually we think, you know, P53 is lost in tumors, and, you know, people are saying that, oh, maybe we should reintroduce P53 in the tumors to, like, get rid of them. And now they're saying here that, like, if you get rid of P53, these tumors, like, totally grow. Like, it's weird.
Yeah, that was a very strange paper. I didn't really get it. But, like, it's the P53, dependent senescence of fibroblasts that can support
cancer
cells, right?
Yeah.
It was, pretty crazy. Where was that published? PNAS, I think?
Good question.
I think it was. I'm not sure, though.
So, I mean, that could be part of
it.
As you get older, you get these senescent cells that are basically, like,
tumor-promoting
environment.
Right, so, like, you know when you do things that, like, all kinds of senescence marker go up and up in, like, in older people. And you can find, like, you know, a fibroblast that are senescent. And, you know, some of the aging theories are that your number of stem cells decreases, and then your number of senescent cells and senescent niches, like, go up throughout your body.
So maybe senescent niches are more likely to support, like, tumors.
Exactly. So maybe it's senescence that promotes tumor and not so much, like, uncontrolled growth. It's just that you've got these, like, you know, environments where it's really easy for a cell to, like, grow on top of.
Yeah, where it's very easy for other cells to take advantage of the senescent cells.
Yeah.
Whereas
in a young person, maybe you get these same tumor cells that are having uncontrolled growth, but they can't find a spot to grow, and then they get rid of by the immune system.
Because the rest of your cells are growing and taking advantage of the same resources that they were trying to be and exploit.
Yeah, they just can't compete.
Yeah,
whereas
they can't compete. Yeah.
No person, they can, they, like, only
totally
compete, but they...
Yeah, okay, I consider thinking about my bunny, like, how come I have a pet bunny rabbit, and I was wondering, like, if it is supposed to be... hibernating. I mean, obviously I know that there are rabbits that don't hibernate. I mean, there's, like, the Arctic hare and, like, all these other types of things, but apparently bunny rabbits are not supposed to hibernate. So I guess they stay up all winter, which is pretty interesting, because there's somebody at the hospital that I wonder what they do in the winter, but... because Ottawa's freezing cold. But yeah, like, the number of mammals and others that hibernate is actually pretty small. It's, like, hibernation must be, like, a pretty broad term, because, like, so there's, like, you know, mammals like chipmunks, like, in that whole sort of squirrel-type animal. Then there's bears, bats, skunks, marmots, raccoons. But then there's things like frogs, turtles, earthworms, and snails. So that was kind of interesting. Like, it's obviously not just a mammal-specific phenomenon. I mean, maybe the term hibernation is really old and isn't really applicable when they talk about, you know, animals that are so diverse, but, there's other types of hibernation. Actually, you mentioned one in a comment, but I found torpor and estivation, and you found, what was the other one you found?
Brunation. So I actually, like, was looking up, you know, because of your comments, I was looking at what happens in the reptiles, and I found this brumation. At first, I had to double read it because I thought it said burnination first. And then they talk about the bearded dragon. And I'm like, oh man, that sounds dirty. And then when I click on it, it's like camels that are dragon.
Yeah, I've got a bearded dragon whose name is Trogdor.
Yeah, exactly.
He doesn't
burnate.
But he doesn't brumate. No, he gets pretty lethargic, but he's pretty much awake all the time.
So I read, like, the comment about this guy who just puts his dragon in a drawer for a couple of months because it doesn't move anymore. So just closes the drawer and then it stays in there, and then once it's done, gets it out of the drawer.
Drogdor, person in England countryside.
But it's one of those things, right, where, like, yeah, so in the wild they, like, brumate or whatever, but, like, inside it's, like, temperature control. Like, for them it's mostly, like, when the temperature drops they sort of become less active because, you know, they're cold-blooded. But when they're inside with the heat lamp, yeah, they tend not to go into this, like, hibernation, well, brumation phase or whatever.
Apparently hibernation is P53 dependent. So I was, like, fishing with this guy who's a PI at Carlton U.
Okay, so it's a fishing story.
Yeah, it's a fishing story.
I once caught one.
He's an expert in hibernation. And he was, like, looking at the hibernation of all kinds of different species. And particularly, like, one of the species that he was talking to me about was the bat. And I was like, it's a P53 dependent process. And
who studies bats and has P53 knockout
bats?
I know, and that's like...
And how do they
connect it to hibernation?
I know!
Like, wow, these guys don't sleep.
Yeah, like, how do you... That's insane.
The guy has over 200 publications. He's one of the most published researchers in Canada. It's because he works on these, like, wacky organisms. Like, who else works on bats and frogs and P53? Like, a handful of people. So it's really easy to get published.
Bats are kind of like mice. Maybe you can just crossbreed them with your pocket mouse.
Maybe. Have you guys heard about that dog hibernation thing? So apparently it's possible to, like, if you infuse, like, a saline solution that's, close to freezing point into a dog, you know,
that's cryogenics, though.
Yeah, cryogenics, I guess. But that they're suggesting that in every mammal, there's a latent, possibility of hibernation.
Yeah, well, that's what this paper was that I, like, talked about. So, yeah, they, like, actually induce hibernation in, like, mice using hydrogen sulfide. So, like, I guess just by, like, high dose of smelling it or something like that, you can, like, induce them to, like, go into hibernation.
Makes sense. You want to pass out and rob farts or something.
Yeah, no, I mean, exactly, right?
Yeah.
No, I know. It's so funny that it's hydrogen sulfide. Like, probably the stinkiest chemical known.
Yeah.
Come on, but... Yeah, and...
Who came up with that idea? Let's, like, put rotten egg smell over my animals.
Yeah, I don't know how they got the chemical... Like, I wonder if they know more... Like, I don't know.
So, what happens when you do that? You think, like, you know, if you take an organism, like, and make them spend 6 months of the year in hibernation, will they end up living twice as long? Like, does that count as, like...
For sure, it's got to be caloric restriction, and it's got to be, like, you know, reduced metabolism, I'm for sure.
And P53 goes up the roof. There you go. It's not like a tumor cell can grow rapidly in a 4-degree environment.
Yeah, so there you go. Like, we can live longer, like... You just need to stop doing stuff.
So yeah, and actually, like I actually recommend listening to the Quirks and Quarks like audio on like this hibernation thing. It's actually they talk to like a number of people in the field, and like it's really quite interesting that like that many people are studying it. Because like yeah, can you imagine that if you can chemically induce hibernation in humans? Like, I mean, so many cool applications. And I mean,
we're all thinking alien. Like,
yeah.
You know, space transport, I guess.
Okay, well, yeah, that was one of the suggestions for sure, but, like, also just for medical purposes, say you're sick and you're young. Say you're, you know, why not just hibernate until there's a cure or something, you know? Like,
I want to hibernate until the Wii comes out, no? Have you guys seen the latest South Park? That's what Cartman tries to do, is, like, go into hibernation until the Wii comes out.
Wii? What?
The new Nintendo Wii? And then they forget him, and then he goes on in hibernation until, like, 2400.
So you just have to, like, time your hibernation properly to pick, like, the best period in history to live in.
Yeah.
And then just make yourself hibernate appropriately.
See, now, I think the best would be is if you could coordinate your hibernation, and then also for humans have a mating season. Wouldn't a mating season be awesome? You could get, like, think of how much girls distract you guys. Come on.
Yeah, if you get all concentrated in a couple of months. So you sleep for 6 months when it's crappy outside.
Yeah, exactly.
And you party for another, like, 4 months, and then you have sex for 2 months, and that's your life.
Yeah, exactly.
And, like, so I could feel even worse about myself.
But, like, you could think, like, during the, like, you know, whatever it is months that you have, like, that you're not hibernating or not in the mating season or whatever, like, that's all, you know, you just be awake 24 hours a day. Think of how productive you could be. Like, you know?
So basically, you want everything to go backwards.
You could, like, up your productivity just by concentrating, like, all the, you know, unproductive stuff that you do in your life, like, in certain seasons.
Well, we definitely, like,
winter,
especially, like, in Ottawa, winter is a total waste of time. Like, I'd like to skip that out. Winter is just not productive.
Yeah. We got our first snow today.
Oh, yeah, that was brutal.
Yeah, I was thinking about doing a post on snowflakes.
But do you think maybe those guys in the Bible that lived so long, like, maybe they were hibernating?
It didn't say they weren't hibernating.
I didn't say that they weren't.
You know what?
It was implicit.
There is so
absence of proof. Is that proof of absence?
Like, Noah, he was on the ark for, like, a long freaking time. He must have been hibernating.
Well, the animals were there.
Like,
they're all
hibernating. He lived 600 years.
Can you imagine mating season on the ark?
Well, imagine when that rain stopped.
It was, like, only 40 days.
It was rocking in there.
If the ark is rocking, don't come and knock it.
But what about the guys that got lost in the desert for 40 years? Maybe they were estimating or something.
For the Jews?
Yeah.
That was probably... probably you got like all these new like explosion of like new speciation events happening too, right? Because they only had like one of each species to mate with. Like what happens when they like, you know, if they don't like the other like mate that they're given or whatever, like they have to find another species.
You'd have to get some people with some kinky fetishes.
Well, the ones that you extra could species. Eat for like use for food, they brought more than one of each. Like,
yeah.
So it was like two of every animal, but like seven or something if you could eat them.
Was that last podcast we were talking about, like, I remember they didn't talk about plants?
Yeah. Was it lunch or was it podcast?
I get those two mixed up too all the time.
But yeah, we were talking about that, like, they don't talk about like two of every plant species.
Where are the plants on Noah's Ark?
Maybe he just, they're in the wood that he had. They just have all plants instead of a ball.
Maybe
he assumed
that
the
seeds are
okay.
Right.
Maybe it was just animals. Because, I don't know, did plants sin? Like, maybe they hadn't sinned.
No, but if you're thinking the whole world being destroyed by, like, a flood, then presumably the plants would also be, like, overwatered or something, like, whatever.
Yeah, and fungus and bacteria and, like...
Wasn't that, like, the whole flood was, like, wasn't that just God punishing man? And, like, why did the animals have to suffer? Like, that's pretty brutal. Like,
you think he has all these powers.
Animals are
you
pretty secondary.
Off,
Human in the, you know,
the Bible.
The next post is...
another cold one.
Oh, he's back.
Dude.
He's back. He's back for his second round.
Next
okay.
This is by Rob.
Yeah.
Maybe we should have Camel talk.
Yeah, I think this is more Chris's alley.
Yeah, he's the Cirti one.
I like, mentioned it to him and I thought he posted it, but he did, so I posted it.
Well, because I'm swimming in Cirti one all the time. So, anyways, this is something that Rob posted basically to make fun of me, I think. But there was a paper recently that was published that showed that resveratrol, which is a Sirtu or Sirti1 activator. So Sirti1 is a protein that's involved in caloric restriction dependent life extension. And so what these guys showed was that resveratrol, like this, it's a small molecule that's found in red wine, can be used to extend the life of, well, it's been shown that it can extend the life of worms, but it can be used in mice to extend their lifespan as well. And so I guess the idea is that this is like a mimic of caloric restriction. So it's been established, like caloric restriction is the one way that's been consistently shown in a variety of species to be able to extend lifespan. And it seems that resveratrol acts in a similar way. So basically this paper was talking about, I guess it's sort of pointing you in a direction where you can now take, you know, potentially a pill or, you know, drink red wine or whatever, get some sort of resveratrol or... I guess, as Rob was saying in the Nature podcast, resveratrol-like compounds to extend lifespan. So it's kind of a neat thing, and I work on Sirti1, so I'm obviously biased. But but I will say, so I went to a conference recently, like in June.
The Blueberry Conference?
Sorry?
The
Blueberry Conference, the American Aging Association. And so they had done, it wasn't so much resveratrol, but they'd done a lot of caloric restriction, like, in doing that, in like, in showing data regarding caloric restriction, which is supposedly how resveratrol works. And so, yeah, it does extend lifespan, but in a lot of cases, like, if you do it in primates, for example, like, you know, you starve these monkeys, but they live, like, 2 months longer kind of thing. So it's, you know, a cost-benefit type scenario where, you know, yes, you're living longer, but how much longer for, you know, not being able to eat, like, steak and eggs and, like, yeah. And blueberries apparently are also very good for lifespan extension based on their... antioxidant properties.
So is this antioxidants, or do blueberries contain resveratrol?
That I'm not sure, but the way they, so the guy, who, the blueberry guy, was talking mostly about antioxidant, and so that goes to the, you know, oxidation theory of aging, where it's just an accumulation of cellular damage from respiration.
So resveratrol, I mean, I'm not trying to quiz you here, but like, I'm just wondering, like, so is resveratrol is an antioxidant?
Yeah.
Is it like a powerful antioxidant, or is it like just it's because it's, you know, how it's Sirti1 dependent apparently.
So it's supposed,
like,
to be an activator. So if you like, so if you pitch in resveratrol, so it like tends to increase Sirti2 activity in like various assays that they use, which typically are deacetylation assays. Now there's also some controversy around resveratrol being a Sirti2 activator. So it's been shown that it tends to work in a specific assay context and not like in all. So there's a kit that you can buy called with a synthetic substrate called fleur-de-lis, and it seems to that resveratrol activates Sirti2 in terms of the fleur-de-lis assay, but not necessarily in other assays, so it's like a substrate-specific SIRT2 activator.
Wow.
So, I mean, the whole field is kind of, like, muddy, like, and it's hard to say what's going on. I mean, but...
They're just competing to get the Methuselah Prize.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
I always wonder...
But it's only they're extending life of these mice by... The guy on the Mish podcast said 15 to 20%.
Yeah.
And I mean, that is modest.
It's still impressive.
Is it not? Like, if you're talking about Methuselah Prize, it's nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, 20% is like a year.
Of course, you could add this onto other types of treatments to get Methuselah Prize, but like I'm just saying, I don't know.
But once you've got a compound, you can try to like modify it. Maybe you can get more action, more frequency.
And more specific, he was talking about like a specific resveratrol for. They had some mice who had like, they'd give them like, you know, the McDonald's, like, he even said this, I think, like
the McDonald's
diet for mice, and then you have like the regular mice, and then he'd show that. You know, the ones who had this crappy diet had like fatty livers and stuff. But the ones that also had resveratrol, same diet, no fatty liver, like not in the same age-associated problems. And so, you know, it looks like it's going to protect you from a bunch of like things. So you can, it's, yeah, I don't know, it's pretty interesting. Like,
so
it has this theory that it's like very broad.
So part of the thing, and one of the things that came up at this conference, and we sort of, like Tony was kind of talking about it earlier, like it's, lifespan extension versus like reduced aging. So, I mean, you were saying like they're the same thing, and I guess they kind of are. But it, like one is, you know, sort of a chronological thing, live longer. But then one is like your health
quality
span,
of life,
like versus lifespan. So I think what it mostly does, like especially so if you're in lower organisms, like it works really well for extending lifespan. Like C. elegans, like you can get them to live for a really long time. But then once you know you move up to mice and you get a reduced like efficacy, and you move up to like primates, and it's even like less so it's more like...
Well, have they even done primate studies?
Yeah, they have. Like, not with resveratrol, but with caloric restriction.
Oh, okay.
So, which is supposed to be how this works. So it's more of like a health span versus lifespan, so like you have a higher quality of life, but there's, you know, there is some sort of endpoint. Like, yeah, and it's a good thing for sure, like if you can live longer, healthy years.
But that's the other thing I'm saying, like, it's not caloric restriction dependent, this resveratrol treatment. Can like have your all the shit you want.
No, that's what it does. It mimics caloric restriction, so you have all the shit that you want, but like you don't see the calories the same way.
Yeah,
like it's a mimic of caloric restriction.
Right,
like so you can consume the calories, but it.
Yeah, that's, I don't know. It was cool. It was awesome.
Well, there's definitely interesting stuff going on there, but it's interesting that like red wine always gets the credit, or it's like it's cool to like say
that's
that
just the buzzword in pop side.
But like, why not drink, you know, eat red grapes, because that's where it's actually coming from, right? And like these antioxidants are rich in
resveratrol, it's an alcohol, right?
No, but it says the source of it is the skin of red grapes.
Yeah.
And like all, you know, everyone's known for a long time that like there's tons of antioxidants, and like, I don't know, Linus Pauling had this big thing about vitamin C is the cure for cancer, and I'm going to eat like 10,000 grams of vitamin C every day, and like that's not that's basically an old idea, like coming back and like, you know, you can kind of, I mean, obviously all this research, molecular research is new, but like in terms of the marketing, the idea, like, oh, red wine is good for you, like it's kind of...
It's not the wine itself, it's not something to do with the wine.
And there's lots of other things in wine, like alcohol, that, you know, have negative health effects.
Oh, that's your drink.
Coffee.
You can't just one a day, though.
Yeah. Alright, I think this wraps up the third episode of the Babe Lab podcast.
Excellent.
Party on motherfuckers.
That's right. So it's the motherfucking Babe Lab podcast at motherfucking babelab.blogspot.com. And you can find us on iTunes, and we've got the explicit tags, motherfuckers. You know, rowing across the Atlantic, the Pacific, and the height across the continent.
Rowing, no, they're sailing or something.
They are rowing.
No, they have sails up.
No, they are rowing, I'm not joking. And they're using currents and stuff.
It just amazed me. I remember, like, I had, like, solar panels on a calculator, I think in grade 5. And, like, I'm old. So that was, like, a long time ago. And, like, yeah, where is that? Like, and I have a solar power calculator right now. I love it, man. I don't have to worry about it being on. It's just like, it's the only thing I have, though. It's the only thing I own.
But at the end of the experiment, they're all female. And we've got an explicit tag, so, you know, we have to, like, swear a lot more.
Okay, yeah.
Because, I mean, this fucking podcast fucking rocks.
Oh. Oh, do we have another
one? Well, I think Stephen Hawking is opening another one, and it's going to blow.
It's amazing he has that, like, you know, like, bottle opener right on his chair.
Oh my god, I'm pissed. Fuck.